The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Werke, and Judge Halbrooks, the Honorable Lucinda E. Jessen presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's June 24th, 2020, and this is the second of three oral arguments we have before us this morning. You will note that you can view Judge Halbrooks and myself. I'm Lucinda Jessen. Judge Werke's video is not available. Judge Werke is able to talk with us, and she can see us, though we cannot see her picture. So you will be able to see to hear her, and I apologize, you will not be able to see her as well. So before we get started, just a few reminders. I think our proceedings really are very similar to those in our physical courtrooms. Each side will have 15 minutes for their oral argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I would ask each of you to state your name at the beginning of your argument so that when people are listening to the recordings, they'll know who is talking. And our timekeeper will have the time up on one of the screens before you, so we'll all be able to keep track of the time. But if you have any trouble with the video or any audio or any mechanics, for example, your screen freezes, you're having a hard time hearing us, just let us know and we can adjust the time because we want to make sure everyone is able to fully avail themselves of this opportunity for argument. So with that, our case is Hall versus Drew, A19-1607. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Lee Hutton. I'm from the law firm of Hutton, Clues, and Evans. This appeal is based on the lower court's discretion to rule on facts that are not in the record. This is an important phenomenon because the court, as you see in the record, embellished certain findings that were not testified, and we'll talk about that. This is even more important because this has a damaging effect with the use of an OFP that they have on a person's life, and also with regard to a relationship of their minor daughter. These OFPs have lasting consequences, and if there are records of unsupported testimony that says something happened when it didn't, the court, and this is reason why the appeal is happening, is significantly problematic. Now, the issue at play, as the Your Honors are aware, is whether appellant Martin Urich, my client, inflicted fear or intimate harm, physical harm, bodily injury, or assault against respondent Melissa Hall under the Minnesota Domestic Act. So let's talk about that. Now, it's clear that Hall's testimony failed to establish that Urich intended to cause, did cause, fear of physical or intimate harm. I want to just remind the court that the law is also clear too, that when a court abuses its discretion, or it has abused its discretion, when its findings are unsupported by the record. So let's talk about the district court's unsupported findings. The court made four findings to determine that the OFP should be granted, but two in the record are clearly unsupported by testimony. First, in 2016, the court found that Urich choked Hall. If you look at the record, there was no testimony of the word choked. There was no testimony with regard to the act of choking to prevent somebody.
Mr. Hutton, the testimony even from your own client, Mr. Urich, was that he grabbed Hall by her neck. And I understand your argument, you're saying that it's embellished, but isn't this a situation where the district court has both parties testifying and makes credibility determinations as to what actually happened?
Yes, Your Honor, no doubt the court has the ability to make credibility decisions, but what the court does not have the ability to do is to place words into an order that were not testified to. And what was testified was the act of grabbing the throat or the neck, not even throat, where Melissa Hall removed the arm. Now, if you further that testimony, Melissa Hall even testified that there was no harm that there was no injuries, which are also elements to establish that fact. The issue is when you put choked versus grabbing. So if I were to grab your shoulder, does that imply any physical harm? Does it imply anything else? And so the heuristics of this argument are very important because of the heinous act that is implied. And the court uses this to find the totality of circumstances back in 2016. This motion was argued in 2019 when the time that these parties didn't live with each other and were not in a vicinity of one another for quite some time, 3 years. Now, the second issue that the court found was that Melissa Hall faked asthma because she was afraid the behavior would escalate. That, again, is not supported by testimony.
But again, in that particular case, and I understand that one or two instances are not dispositive, but where Hall testified that she faked asthma attacks, the order of the court says he finds her testimony to be credible. And we have that finding. We can't substitute our judgment.
Well, I don't think you have to substitute judgment at all. What you do have is to look at the record. And in the record, Hall states that she faked asthma attack not to stop some imminent threat of physical harm. She faked the asthma attacks to calm him down from yelling. Now, as the law in Minnesota supports, yelling is not something that an OFP should be granted. Otherwise, we would have many of them out there granted.
Mr. Hutton, isn't that just a fact that kind of goes to this issue of was there fear of imminent harm? You know, if someone, there's this history of yelling, isn't that at least one factor that the district court should be looking at to support the finding of that fear?
Well, if you look at the Your Honor, and I would agree with you that the court should look at that fact. But if you look at Melissa Hall's testimony, she said that she was not in fear of imminent harm. That's not in testimony. As a matter of fact, Ms. Hall also testified that the reason for the OFP was to prevent Mr. Urich, my client, from interfering with medical decisions.
Mr. Hutton, maybe you can address this for me, though. Because I follow your argument on that to a point, but then I saw this language where she did testify, I'm scared he's just going to get triggered and snap and do something to harm me. I mean, she said that, I mean, admittedly, right after she's talking about her concern for her daughter, but that was her concern about harm for herself. And the district court found that credible.
Well, Your Honor, certainly I'm not discrediting that statement, but that alone doesn't focus on the OFP. And I'm bringing us back to, it has to be imminent physical harm. You gotta remember that this motion was brought in 2019, and she's talking about an incident that happened in 2016. The parties no longer live together. They weren't in the same house. And to find the fact that 3 years later, that an individual who was yelling, which there was no current events of any yelling, no current events of situations, to find the totality of circumstances with the judge used the choking.
Mr. Hutton, in Pavkovnik, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, isn't that exactly though, contrary to what the court found, that the present intent to inflict fear of physical harm or bodily injury can be viewed under the totality of the circumstances and a past history. And if you remember that case, talked about a 16 year on and off relationship. And isn't that exactly what Hall testified to here, is that things would escalate, or they would, I think her words were ramp up. Does that not require us to look at the totality of their relationship?
Ramp up to what, Your Honor? Ramp up to physical harm? That was not the testimony. Ramp up to Mr. Urich preventing his daughter from seeing professionals of medical care? That it's not enough. And with regard to the case that you cited, Your Honor, with all due respect, it talked about a present situation. We're talking about a 2019 OFP that was specifically testified to have been brought to prevent the father from interfering with medical decisions. The incidents, albeit one with regard to testimony, happened in 2014. And so when you say current or present, that does not exist here, Your Honor. Now, if you look at the Pechnovich case, where they had the current and repeated incidents of slapping the feet, I know the court is very familiar with that. It's distinguished in this situation that this incident happened 6 years ago with regard to this totality of incidents. There was no testimony that Mr. Uhrich was doing anything to threaten intimate harm in the 2016, 2017, 2018, or 2019 period. And that's where I think this case is distinguishable. Most importantly, I think the court, while the totality of circumstances, also erred in applying the standard that the basis for this OFP was to prevent the father from interfering with medical decisions. There was not one instance where there was anything where she said, I was at harm. And even if you look at the OFP application that was signed ex parte, it talks about the kid being harmed, and that was dismissed. And so there is a significant issue with regard to the embellishing of the facts or the court abusing its discretion to put facts in there that they don't exist. Now, with regard to all this, we still have an issue of imminent harm and the present danger with two people who don't even live together. They live in separate households. There was no questioning of how far those households were, but if it was important to elicit that in the record, which was not, the petitioner neither testified that it was his next door neighbor, never testified that Marty Uhrich got in a car, never testified, as some of the cases said, I'm going to get you tomorrow. No. What happened was an OFP that I will state on the record was unfortunately executed in an abusive fashion to prevent Mr. Uhrich from interfering with medical decisions for his daughter. That is not a requirement under the OFP for protection. What they did do is try to use a 2014 and 2016 incident, which words that the court stated was testified, which would never testify to, and no intimate physical harm, to define the totality of their circumstances. Here, the OFP just quite frankly was not necessary. And the testimony stated that the reason why the OFP was brought, not in 2014, not in 2016, not in 17, 18, it was brought in 2019 after Mr. Uhrich met with a custody evaluator and gave two individuals, him and the mother, legal and joint custody. And that was testified to as her motivation.
So, Mr. Hutton, if you would, could you please address the recent case from the Minnesota Supreme Court, I think it's Thompson versus Shermer. And because I hear you talking about, look, how could this be, you know, imminent harm? How could this meet the standard given the length of the period of time? But there the Supreme Court seemed to say, look, a petitioner needs to only show physical harm or bodily injury at some point, that we're not going to put time limits on it.
Yes, and that's a new case that is not putting time limits on this going back to 2004, 2016. However, there is, from my recollection, at least some caution with regard to how you're going to use those time limits as a history. In the cases that I'm familiar with, there's certainly a more severity and some more frequency with regard to this. And then there is at least some connection to a current imminent harm, which we don't have here. We don't have a current threat. What we have here is testimony that the father is interfering with medical decisions. We don't have a current threat that in 2019, Marty Uhrich threatened me with imminent harm or created physical harm. And there's a difference in those cases. And so to use the totality of a history, you have to connect that with something present. Or otherwise, anybody with the OFP, whether it be a legitimate OFP or be an OFP to position themselves in a custody battle, is forever damned. They cannot escape that. And that's why you have to have a current testimony of physical imminent harm that's connected to past testimony of physical imminent harm. And I think that's appropriate because it shows a consistent behavior. Also, in many of those cases, the individuals had at least some type of living arrangement within the house in a domestic fashion, which we don't have here. You would also have a living arrangement where there was constant contact with the other side. That's not in the testimony. And so therefore, I think reversal is appropriate.
Mr. Hutton, I want to ask you a follow-up question on the custody evaluation, because respondent says that your client filed his petition for custody 1 year and 5 months after this petition, and then 7 months after the evaluation report. So, you know, there doesn't seem to be close proximity of time. Does that in any way weaken your argument with respect to motivation here?
No, not at all, because my client's actions shouldn't be addressed with regard to the filing of the OFP. The testimony from Mrs. Hall, which we have to use her testimony, not my client's actions or testimony, to their favor, is that she testifies that she used the OFP to prevent the custody evaluation and the joint legal custody. That was her testimony.
Okay, thank you.
And so I will just close while I have 41 seconds. You have a couple of issues at play. You have the court embellishing the record. Actual testimony is not compliant or is incongruent with the court's findings. And especially if you really read the testimony, and I put it out, Melissa Hall even testifies that in present circumstances, she neither received any harm and didn't fear imminent harm. And I think that's very important. I think that's distinguishable from the prior cases.
Thank you, Mr. Hutton. You'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Your Honor. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Katie Kelly, and I represent the respondent, Ms. Melissa Hall. I appreciate the opportunity to appear electronically before you this morning. For the court's reference, I am using dual monitors. The monitor directly before me has the web camera, and both in front of me and on the second monitor to my right, I have additional notes. If I look over to my right while speaking, which I will try not to do, please be aware I'm looking at my second monitor. Your Honors, in the matter before you, appellant Mr. Jurek is requesting that you overturn the district court's decision to issue an order for protection on the ground that the district court abused its discretion by finding that appellant inflicted fear of imminent physical harm against respondent, as well as making findings that were unsupported by the record. The standard for review for this court in an order for protection matter is whether the district court abused its discretion. The district court in this matter, as the court of first impression, had significant discretion in determining whether to issue an order for protection pursuant to the Remedial Domestic Abuse Act and found in Minnesota Statute Section 518B. Upon completion of its role as trier of fact and in weighing the preponderance of the evidence before it, the district court appropriately exercised its discretion to enter an order for protection against appellant. This order must be affirmed. The district court in this matter made numerous particularized findings, both verbally on the record following the evidentiary hearing and written, after hearing more than a full day of testimony from both parties and respondent's mother. Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 52.01 tells us that a court's findings, whether based on oral or documentary evidence, shall not be set aside unless the findings are clearly erroneous. In its oral findings following the hearing, the district court acknowledged that respondent's burden of proof as the petitioner in an order for protection matter was to establish statutory domestic abuse by a preponderance of the evidence. In the instant matter, the majority of the evidence before the court was witness testimony. It was therefore necessary for the district court to weigh the relative credibility of the witness testimony, which both the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure and case law have repeatedly held is wholly within the discretion of the trial court as the court of first impression. The district court made express findings that respondent's testimony was more credible than appellant's regarding two instances of what qualified as physical harm, which is one of the potential alternative definitions of domestic abuse pursuant to Minnesota Statutes 518B.01 Subdivision 2. The district court also made express findings that respondent's testimony was more credible regarding the past interactions between the parties, which led respondent to be in fear of appellant. These interactions included repeated incidents in which appellant would corner respondent in their shared home, screaming at her and standing in the doorway to block her from leaving the room she was in. While appellant characterized these incidents as tough conversations, respondent at times found it necessary to fake asthma attacks to get appellant to stop yelling at her because she was fearful for her safety and was afraid.
Can I just interrupt here for a moment, Ms. Kelly? Because I'm just trying to look at the different bases for the domestic abuse finding. I mean, one obviously is kind of the past physical harm or bodily injury. But when we get to the infliction of fear of imminent harm, that one, as I think Mr. Hupp was arguing, that is harder for me to get my arms around. How is it imminent if, you know, they're living apart, these physical things happened a long time ago? I have no doubt your client had fear when they were happening, but boy, that's a long time. That was a long time ago. And here, when you couple that length of time with what seems to be driving this is just her desire to figure out, to make sure she gets to make the medical decisions for her daughter, I have a hard time. And so maybe you could tell me more about, you know, where the support is for the infliction of fear of imminent harm.
Yes, Your Honor. Pursuant to Thompson v. Scrimshier, the 2018 Minnesota Supreme Court case Your Honor referenced previously, upon establishment of either instance of physical harm in this matter, the district court could then have properly exercised its discretion to determine whether an order for protection was necessary. It was not necessary after establishment of past physical harm for the court to make the additional finding that that respondent was in fear of imminent physical harm at the time of the filing of petition. The district court had discretion to issue an order upon establishment of the past physical abuse.
So if there's physical or bodily harm at some point in a relationship, then is it always going to be able, or is the petitioner always going to be able to go and, you know, 10 years later, 15 years later, get an OFP because of the fear of imminent physical harm?
Your Honor, Thompson v. Scrimshier speaks to that specifically and says that that was what the respondent in Thompson v. the appellant in Thompson v. Scrimshier argued was, does past physical harm guarantee an order for protection? And the answer was no. A district court may provide relief pursuant to the Domestic Abuse Act upon the establishment of past physical harm. It does not require an order for protection, but the court must then examine the relevant circumstances in the case before it to determine whether an order for protection is warranted.
Ms. Kelly, in the Thompson case, the holding that there is no temporal requirement when domestic abuse occurs leads us in a situation where you could have 30 years that have passed and you could still argue no temporal requirement. And I think the Thompson case, it was a much shorter period of time. So are you saying that in relying on Thompson on your client's behalf that we can forget any period of time and the fact that they don't live together? Isn't that the totality of the circumstances?
Your Honor, Thompson tells us that the relevant circumstances may include, but are not limited to, the timing, frequency, and severity of any alleged instances of domestic abuse. The relevant circumstances of a case is a purposely broad term used by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and it allows the district court to determine the relevant circumstances on a case-by-case basis.
Well, Mr. Hutton, in answer to one of my questions, says, I'm paraphrasing what he said, but you know, imminent harm, what does ramped up mean? I mean, it really doesn't mean anything. There wasn't any harm after her complaint of ramping up. How do we put that in a right or a correct context?
Your Honor, Thompson v. Scrimshier, it says that upon establishment of domestic abuse, the district court may examine all relevant circumstances. And in this case, that included the respondent's recognition of the escalation and ramping up of appellant's behavior. Respondent was fearful of appellant and what he might do to her, as she was the decision maker who was following medical recommendations with which he objected. This fear was reasonable. Given the existence of past domestic abuse and the history of coercive and abusive interactions between the parties, which the district court had already found respondent had sufficiently established. To expand on that further, Your Honor, when the party's daughter began having medical issues that required specialized treatment, respondent was already the sole legal custodian at that point. The parties had never married, and she was the one who was responsible for making the decisions to follow the recommendations of the medical professionals. Appellant disagreed with these decisions, and again, respondent saw and recognized appellant's pattern of escalating anger and erratic behavior, not only with respondent, but also with the daughter's medical providers. The district court recognized this in its nuanced finding that respondent was in reasonable fear of harm by appellant when respondent was making medical decisions for their daughter. Another point addressed by appellant in his argument just now is the fact that respondent and appellant do not live in the same household. They have not resided in the same household for 3 years. Your Honors, the Act anticipates that relief may need to be granted to protect a party who does not reside with the abusing party. Minnesota Statute Section 518B.01, Subdivision 6A2, expressly states that the court may exclude the abusing party from the dwelling which the parties share or from the residence of the petitioner. It is not required to find imminent harm that the parties be living together. The totality of the circumstances in this case very much included the parties' interactions surrounding the medical treatment of their daughter. Appellant also referenced Pachovnik in his argument just now, arguing that this matter differs from Pachovnik in the severity and remoteness of the past physical harm. I believe it is important to note It is important to note that Pachovnik was decided by the Court of Appeals prior to the Thompson v. Scrimshire decision. The district court in Pachovnik found an existence of domestic abuse, a fear of imminent physical harm, based on a history of past domestic abuse in conjunction with ongoing interactions between the parties. Following the Thompson v. Scrimshire decision, the past physical abuse found by the district court in Pachovnik would have arguably been a sufficient basis on its own for the district court to issue an order for protection. Arguably, the district court in Pachovnik may very well have found an alternative sufficient basis for the order for protection had the case come before the court following the Thompson v. Scrimshire decision. Your Honor, what appellant is effectively asking you to do is to reweigh the evidence presented to the district court to arrive at a different conclusion. This is inappropriate. This court's role as the reviewing court is not to act as a court of first impression. This court's role as the reviewing court is to view the district court's decision in the light most favorable to the district court. This court does not reconcile conflicting evidence or determine the credibility of witness testimony. The latter is of significant importance in the instant matter, as the majority of the evidence on the appellate record is witness testimony. Even if this court determines that it does view the evidence differently, this is not a sufficient basis for overturning the district court's decision. The Minnesota Supreme Court case Sefkow v. Sefkow confirms this. The Minnesota Supreme Court in Sefkow holds that the Court of Appeals inappropriately reversed the lower court, despite the lower court making voluminous findings and repeatedly justifying a finding with the words, based on the credibilities of the witnesses. The Supreme Court found that the trial court's role was to do exactly that. Your Honors, in this case, the district court took great pains to make findings based on the credibilities of the witnesses, expressly stating numerous times that respondent's testimony was more credible than appellant's with regard to two acts of physical harm, as well as establishing there was fear based on the interactions between the parties. The Thompson v. Scrimshire allows the court, upon establishment of the domestic abuse that occurred in 2015 and 2016, to subsequently examine the relevant circumstances to determine whether an order for protection is warranted at the time of the petition. And Your Honors, in this case, the relevant circumstances confirmed for the court that the petition for an order for protection should be granted and should be affirmed.
Anything further, Ms. Kelly?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Kelly from the panel?
I have none.
I have none.
Thank you. Mr. Hutton, any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. July 22nd transcript, paragraph 11, line 22 through 12 through 14, 12, 18 through 14, 16 through 18. Those are several sites in the transcript where Ms. Hall testified that Mr. York would become easily jealous, would become angry, but that his jealousy and anger manifested in yelling and arguing, not violence. That was her testimony. If you look through more testimony, you'll find out that with regard to the 2014-2016, there were no injuries from the incident. She immediately put his hand away and there was no OFP. There was no threat of harm in those situations. Those are also her testimony. Even more so, in line 37, or July 27th, the second transcript, 103-4-6, question, did he ever physically harm you or otherwise threaten to harm you since 2016? He never harmed me. These are important circumstances, and I think, no, let me take that back. I know this is not what the Thompson-Scrivner case is trying to allow. In that particular case, I believe, if I remember, there might have been some kicking, some choking, some knocked out, some slapping when the individual was pregnant. We have to find this separation in the act. And I think the act is appropriate. I think past incidents are appropriate because it establishes a person's conduct and behavior over time. However, the law has to allow a person to grow or to change. Especially, we see so many warts and bad behavior with false accusations that are now being caught on video. The Domestic Abuse Act has no protection for somebody who who's defending an accusation years prior, where memories fade, where there's no video. While I'm not here to argue that the act is not appropriate to look at past acts, but what I get from the Scrivener case, there has to be some present danger. Now, what the Supreme Court did not do is they didn't take those key words out. They didn't say, take out the present imminent harm. They didn't take out the current issue when you look at the totality. Because if the court did not, and I have to say that it was intentional, the reason why the court did not is because if any one of us did something inappropriate 10 years ago, 3 years ago, and has been a good citizen in that time period, has curbed any behavior, that means that there's no statute of limitations or no sale ways of somebody bringing a motion 3 years later based on a single past incident. And that's, I have to believe that the Supreme Court did not remove that language for a specific reason, because it would provide a really difficult time for an individual who may have been accused of something, may have done something where there's no OFP and there's no actual credibility finding at that time to be able to defend himself. And so while counsel was arguing on certain issues, I do want to very quickly wrap up, is this is not an argument trying to change what the court found. This is specifically addressing unsupported testimony in the record, which the Minnesota courts, if we also want to look at it, act in case law, says that that's abuse of discretion. If there's facts not in the record, that is used for an order. And especially with an OFP, with the outrageous effects that it has on the individual for life. This is not the time or the place for a mistake or an abuse of discretion to have had in this court. There's testimony. If a person said they weren't harmed and there's no imminent threat, you apply that to the statute. You don't add words. You don't add certain things to create a totality of circumstances. You just simply provide your discretion that's consistent with the law. Thank you.
Thank you both very much for the helpful arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement and a decision will be issued within the statutory time period.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.